Good morning and welcome to Back Chat. I'm Hugh Chewett and your co-host today is Ada Wong. Ada, good morning to you.
Good morning, Hugh.
Today we're talking about COVID-19 and Hong Kong's public spending. The financial secretary says the situation has caused a severe blow to our economy and has revised real GDP growth for 2020 from minus 6% to minus 8%. Meanwhile, the government has already projected a budget deficit of $290 billion after announcing various relief packages since the outbreak, totaling $287.5 billion, assisting affected industries and the public. The stated aims of the policy are, first, to help businesses stay afloat, second, to keep workers in employment, third, to relieve financial burdens of individuals and businesses, and fourth, to assist the economy to recover after the epidemic is contained. Many industries, from the laundry trade to vehicle maintenance, and the self-employed have been targeted in funding so far. Is that effective? And as economic pressure grows, how should the government spend in the rest of the year? Should we be careful because this may be a very long-term problem? Or should we be spending generously now that the rainy day is here? Let us know your thoughts. You can leave a message on our Facebook page, Backchat on RTHK Radio 3. You can email us, backchat@rthk.hk, or you can call us, and our telephone number is 233 88266. 233 88266 is the number to call. Just before we get to today's topic, some reflections from yesterday. Matthew, first of all, our Lama Matthew on Facebook says, any pro-Beijing supporters joining the programme, that's yesterday's programme, to advocate for the health code system and address concerns that this is really a Trojan horse for introducing mainland-style digital surveillance and the social credit system in Hong Kong. Surprised if there are suddenly none willing to join the programme, as last week they were so vocal in advocating it, including the DAB and Starry Lee. And Tom says, it's pretty clear looking around the world, including places like New Zealand, the countries with the least divisive politics tend to have the best coronavirus responses. I hope the pandems don't spread fake news about government measures to help people deal with COVID-19, just because it's an easy way to manipulate people's existential fears for their own political gain. Right now, freedom from worry about COVID-19 is the most important freedom there is. That comes from Tom. John Kowloon says, on yesterday's programme, your guests, Kwok Kar Kee and Professor Cowling, both expressed their lack of support for universal testing, citing the very high cost as a key reason for their view. And while I'm not saying I disagree with their conclusion, it would be incorrect to focus entirely on the cost side of such a programme without factoring in the revenues that Hong Kong is losing due to COVID. Dr. Kwok cited a cost figure of $2.2 billion for each exercise of universal testing, or as much as $100 billion annually if this was carried out weekly. But as Professor Cowling pointed out, this amount could be sharply lowered if a government adopted a mass testing policy. So let's take Dr. Kwok's number of 100 billion, halve it to 50 billion to factor in mass testing. While such a number is still very high, it pales in comparison to the economic damage that COVID is inflicting on the economy. Take just two numbers as examples. In a normal year, i.e. pre-COVID and pre-last year's anti-government protests, tourism spending reached 328 billion, while locals spent around 100 billion in restaurants and bars. Visitor arrivals have since almost entirely dried up, while local consumption at restaurant bars is down sharply. Put another way, COVID is likely to wipe out at least 300 billion from the revenue side of the ledger this year, a multiple of any costs related to a ramp up in testing. That is from John Kowloon. This is from Magnus, who says, thank you to Professor Cowling for another batch of eminently sensible guidelines this morning. He must despair. Nothing has changed. The facts remain as they have throughout. And yet here we are in Hong Kong, still discussing it as though it were some intractable puzzle. The approach to tackle COVID is very well understood. A, secure zones via quarantine borders. B, discipline at the personal level, which aggregates through an effective community response, e.g. masks and hygiene. C, an efficient ongoing testing regime to provide early alert of any outbreak. And D, a properly resourced contact tracing unit so that any outbreak is quickly suppressed. Of these four elements, sadly, the public has control over only one. Surprise, surprise, that is the area where Hong Kong excels. You simply could not ask for a better public response in fighting COVID. What a huge advantage Hong Kong has in this respect. The other three are a huge fail. Sadly, hardly surprising when one considers that even rationalising the fare pricing of the three cross-harbour tunnels is beyond their wit. So the economic economic and social carnage rolls on. Our government has been shown to be derelict in their primary duty, that being the protection of Hong Kong citizens. Displaying outrageous stupidity and recklessness, they wave COVID in via dumb quarantine loopholes. Then, as a result of an inadequate testing regime coupled with an under-resourced contact tracing team, they initially allowed the outbreak crucial time to grow and subsequently have been unable to contain it at proper speed. For a virus, a multiplicative threat, speed of response is absolutely critical. And what provides for speed of response? Preparation. It's not like we don't understand the measures need to be taken. They're the same as we needed ever since COVID arrived. Patently, the Hong Kong authorities have simply not been prepared. What the hell have those clowns been doing since January? The truth is our government has set us up for this enormously damaging debacle through sheer fecklessness. Enough. Sort the borders out. Implement an appropriate ongoing test regime and properly resource the contact tracing. Do this now. We've had enough. It's from Magnus. And Herman says, I have a question. Some have suggested that contact tracing app might be preferable to universal testing. And though I agree that contact tracing apps have tangible value, overseas experience has shown that their take-up and success rate are not as great as many as hoped, notably in America, where contact tracing has largely failed due in large part to inadequate testing and testing delays. And there's a link to the New York Times. Thus, it seems that to be effective, contact tracing apps require timely testing. But at the same time, the data in the app is only as good as the last test, which both assumes that the test produced a correct reading and that the person wasn't affected afterwards. So how can one resolve this dilemma? Thanks very much indeed for those comments. As I say, we're talking mostly about money and finance this morning. Joining us, we have David Webb, chief editor of website.com, and also Felix Cheung, Liberal Party leader and lawmaker, and others will be joining us later in the programme. Once again, if you want to contribute, drop us a line, backchat@rthk.hk, or give us a call. Felix Cheung, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Thank you very much indeed for joining us. So, you know, the government has been helping out, has been, you know, gave $10,000 to everyone. It's been helping the self-employed. It's been targeting these various industries. It's been spending a lot of money so far. What about the rest of the year? As we look at the pattern of the disease and we look at what's happening and the problems that are arising, how do you think the government should be spending its money?
Of course, we look at the second half of the year will be a negative sign. The economy is still dropping. Actually, without the help from the government, without those $300 billion Hong Kong dollars given out by the by the Hong Kong government, certainly the unemployment rate will not be only 6%; it could probably 8 or 9%. And then, as you mentioned, the government paid out to give everybody 10,000 Hong Kong dollars. I think we haven't had the chance to spend the $10,000 because a lot of the people still work at home and not going out to spend money. Yesterday, we had some rumors saying that the government may lift some hours ban for the catering business that allowed them to have the dinner business till 8 or 9 p.m., but unfortunately, it was not the case. Well, then, if we do not have sufficient of economic activities, I mean, then we do worry about the economy that we're facing for the next 6 months until the vaccine has been will be coming out.
Felix, even if we have a vaccine, the outbreak would not be over within this year. It might be all the way until the middle of next year. But, you know, our reserves are shrinking, and quite rapidly. $280 billion is a lot of money.
Yes. Well, then we can we have to think about why do we need that much of reserve? Yes, the government's already spent $300 billion of Hong Kong dollars. Still they have $800 billion reserve in hand. Why can't the government spend maybe another $100 billion for the third round of anti-pandemic fund? For example, helping some business sector for the rent subsidies. I also suggest to help the business sector on, for example, 2% of interest rate subsidies, then you ask how much that will be. I mean, if you're thinking about 300,000 of business registered, around roughly around 300,000 business registered in Hong Kong, if you subsidize them about 30,000 Hong Kong dollars per month for rent subsidies for 3 months, that would cost around 20 billion Hong Kong dollars. If you're talking about 2% of interest subsidies, you're talking about 10 billion Hong Kong dollars.
You mentioned landlord and rent subsidies. How come landlords in Hong Kong can't do more? And we're only asking the government to do more.
Put it this way. You have to separate the landlord in two categories. One are the big tycoon, having all the shopping mall, the big listed company. Well, they are for the first category, but they also many landlords, which are SMB, they may just have rent out their shop branch and getting the rent to pay the mortgage. I mean, they are also suffering. So we have to separate that into two different categories. Don't expect the landlord are the richest guy in Hong Kong and they have sufficient of money to support everybody. They also suffering. But of course, for those tycoon, I mean, they should do more.
But the focus would be then what, on SMEs? One way or another?
The SME in all different industries are suffering. Right. For example, the tourism industry, there's zero business. There's no outbound business at all. I mean, for the catering business, they claim that they only have 30% of the business because there's a ban for the evening business. So for the export business, you know, there is a trade war and all the exports are suffering from the sanction and the trade war situations. So everybody is suffering. So if the government still having around 800 billion of reserve, so definitely the government have to do the third round of anti-pandemic fund, no matter how much it is. I mean, otherwise there will be a huge closing down of business and the unemployment will be rising. I mean, the social costs will be much higher.
Mm. David Webb, good morning to you.
Morning.
Thanks for joining us once again. Do you agree?
I think the money's got to be, I'm not sure I agree with what, but the money's got to be
agree
very
with
well.
What Felix Chung was just saying there about...
Generally, no.
Spend.
No. you've got to be careful with money. Unlike the countries which print their own money, like the UK and the US, where they're simply borrowing a lot of money, which is being funded by bonds purchased by their central banks. So in other words, the banks are then creating the money. We don't have that luxury. We actually have to maintain the peg and spend our real reserves on this. The reserves have been hoarded. They're actually higher than you think. They're not just 1.1 trillion. There's another 500 billion of profits in the exchange fund, which could also be used. So it's higher than you think. We could actually manage about 4 years more of this kind of level of deficit before we got down to near zero reserves. But it has been wasteful spending. For example, the employment subsidy scheme was completely different to all the others in the world. Rather than pay people who had been furloughed because their restaurants had closed or their shops had been forced to close by government law, instead they paid employers to maintain who were still employing people, many of whom had no intention of laying off staff. You know, if you're running a supermarket, for example, or a convenience store, those have been very much in demand. Their sales have gone up because more people are staying at home and cooking at home, and they need all the staff they can get, and they get paid as well half the cost of those staff, basically. So they've got a bumper windfall there. Instead, the money could have been used to pay for the relatively smaller number of unemployed people as a result of the COVID measures, and that could have then been more sustainable. You've got to look at smaller schemes that ought to be implemented. For example, why is it that someone who's feeling sick still goes to work and drives their taxi or goes to their wet market and opens their stall? It's because if they don't go to work, they don't get paid. Okay, they're self-employed. They really need the money. And there isn't any statutory sick pay scheme that would compensate them for staying at home. So if you're feeling, and you are, in fact, symptomatic, and you perhaps do have COVID or at least a bad cold, you ought to be staying at home and getting compensated for doing so, but you're more likely to go to work. And I think that's why there's been quite a number of clusters emerging from the markets. Not the supermarkets, of course. I mean, have you heard of any major clusters coming out of the supermarkets? No, because their employees get sick pay. They're on full employment terms, and they're entitled to statutory sick pay. But self-employed people are not. So you could think much more creatively about how to shift the incentives to reduce the infection rates.
Are you saying that money is going to the business owners?
Yes.
They're the benefit, the employees.
Yes, and people will claim it if they're entitled to it. Okay, I have one employee. I claimed my entitlement because these reserves have been hoarded for so many years. And if you're going to give me a handout, I will take it. And the $10,000 scheme, again, most people didn't need that money. It's cost $70 billion, including a lot of people who live overseas but have a Hong Kong bank account and can claim. That's a nasty cough you've got there, Ada. Shouldn't you be at home in bed?
She can't afford it.
The ESS, by the way, has overshot its budget. They budgeted $80 billion, but it looks like it'll be more like $90 billion because they're already over 80, and they're still processing the applications. They've got about 10% left to go.
Who's that?
The employment support subsidy.
Okay.
They're doing it in batches because they've just been overwhelmed by the paperwork. They didn't put enough people onto it, basically, and so the paperwork's taken too long, or they're checking details of applications, and there are still several thousand to process. But the last figure was for the first 3 months it would be over $41 billion, and they're doing it in two phases, so that's $82 billion, and it's probably going to come out at about $90 billion. It was a crazy scheme, but as I said at the time on my website, employers must eat this free lunch, and there's a few employers that didn't because they work with the government, but most did.
But the benefit would be to the employees is that they're less likely to lose their jobs.
But many of them were not likely to lose their jobs anyway. Mm. So you're wasting money by paying money to employers who were fully intended to maintain their staff.
Felix Chung?
Well, without this ESS policy, definitely the unemployment rate will be at least 8 or 9%. Even for some...
Yeah, so give them unemployment benefit. We can afford that. It costs much less than giving money to every employer of every employee in Hong Kong.
The other
91% who are still employed, most of them would still be employed.
This scheme has been discussed many times on the drawback or advantages. I mean, we shouldn't use this time to discuss this anymore.
Because it was so bad?
It's already going.
Well, are they going to repeat it? That's the question. What do we do with our public finances going forward? And I hope that they don't. Because, if you look at the UK, for example, I think they paid furloughed staff 80% of their salaries.
Up to a cap.
And there's an incentive to go back to work and get the other 20%.
Every incentive have advantage and disadvantage. This is not the right time for us to discuss this at this moment.
In the US, it was $1,200 top up.
Well, US give out money to all the business sector. Do not have to pay them back. I mean, can the Hong Kong government afford that? Because, as you said, the government cannot print the money.
Yeah,
the government can print the money.
Well, you're right. We can't afford that kind of wasteful scheme. So we need to focus more on what we can afford, and also put an end to wasteful projects. There's $100 billion allocated to building another science park in the Lok Ma Chau loop. Now, the government should stop trying to direct the economy and allow the free market to function and do what Hong Kong does best rather than what the government thinks we should do best. They're building another phase of the cyber port. I mean, that white elephant is about to have a baby elephant.
That'll take some time.
But we're facing something in
front of ourselves right now.
But the white elephant's going to have a baby elephant. We really don't need that. So.
Don't talk about something 2 years later, that happened 2 years later or 3 years later.
Well, the government's going to be around still.
So we are facing difficulties right now.
Yeah. What about the point of spending more creatively and putting the money to people who are really in need? For example, I know a lot of self-employed people. I don't think they cannot even get any money, any subsidy from the government at all. Market hawkers are not getting anything. Yet the wet markets are now being closed down.
Well, of course, I agree with that. We should help those who are really in need. We also ask the government to pay those people, those elderly people that's over 65 with their MPF accounts. This can be easily made with some declarations from those people. I mean, and also some unemployment subsidies. I mean, many people already got unemployed, and those people are really in need. I mean, these sort of people, we certainly will ask the government to do something on the third round of the anti-pandemic fund.
David Webb, this looks like it's going to be a long-term problem. It just seems to get longer and longer, doesn't it, the projections?
Long haul, yes. I mean, we probably will have a vaccine or several vaccines in the market next year, but we don't yet know how long, what their efficacy will be. Will you give it 100% protection or 70% protection? If it's going to be like the flu vaccine that just reduces the impact but doesn't eliminate it, then what level of infection do we accept as a community? What level of infection does the world accept?
Yeah.
At what point do they stop all of the travel restrictions?
Does that mean we've got to calm down a little bit the spending? We've got to be a little bit more conservative.
I think there's a need for a root and branch reform of the whole revenue system and spending as well. I've spoken many times on your shows over the years on the budget reviews about the need to abolish stupid taxes and be more sensible about other taxes. Stamp duty, for example. We've still got cooling measures, don't forget, to stop people moving around Hong Kong, because every time they move their flat, they have to pay a fee to the government for the privilege of buying one flat and selling another one. Those measures could go. We should also be looking at how we spend the money. Do we really need, for example, a $2 fare scheme for everyone who reaches the age of 60, which I hope to do, because I've got 5 years to go, I won't need it. And most people of the age of 60 don't need that, but it costs about $3 billion a year to do it. So,
Felix Cheung, the government has listed its stated aims in its spending, and the aims are first to help businesses stay afloat. That comes first. Do you agree with that?
Yes, in certain way, because if you don't help the business sector, I mean, the business sector is going down and create a lot of unemployment, and that will end up with a lot of social cost that will never can be, we cannot be estimate. So to help the business sector, certainly it is not just to help the business sector, but also have to help or the individual and employed, as Ada says, a lot of people are self-employed, and they do not have the channel to get any support at all at this moment.
There is a scheme for the self-employed, which addresses the self-employed. They have got
it's only $7,500.
That's right. It's not a lot of money.
Sure. Which is not enough.
But 100,000, I think, have been helped through that. Just quickly before we finish, Felix Cheung, sorry, I just wanted to squeeze in a question for Felix Cheung from a listener. who this is back on on COVID strictly. Matthew says, Felix, do you and the Liberal Party support other Beijing political parties' call for a health code system, which would force Hong Kong people to take mandatory virus tests and sign up for an electronic system, surveillance system, which would grant those who signed up access to shopping malls, restaurants, and maybe even public transport and schools? What's the Liberal Party stance? Would you support a health code system which would give privileges to people who took a test?
No, I think the health code systems can work out well. But, I mean, of course, we do not know the detail. We also need the health code system to go through the border. You know, a lot of people have business in China or they have manufacturing. They have factory in China, really need to take care of the business in China too. I mean, this is the directions we have to think about it and cannot just sit here and do nothing.
Okay. Well, right? Felix Cheung, thanks for joining us, Liberal Party leader and legislator as well. We're going to continue the discussion. David Webb staying with us after the news at 9. Please contribute. Backchat@rthk.hk is our email address, or call us. The weather, mainly cloudy with a few showers, hot with sunny intervals this morning, temperatures up to 31 degrees, squally thunderstorms and more showers later. And the outlook, it's going to be windy with heavy squally showers and thunderstorms tomorrow, still showery on Thursday, 29 degrees now, humidity 78%. Welcome back. This is Backchat on a Tuesday morning with Ada Wong and me, Hugh Tewerton. We're talking about government spending and COVID-19. David Webb joins us in our central studio. He's chief editor of website.com, a financial analyst and commentator. We're also joined now by Dr. Fred Koo, who's assistant dean for undergraduate studies and director of the integrated BBA program at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. We'd like to hear from you too. Your questions and comments, please. 233-88266 is the telephone number if you want to join in. You can email backchat@rthk.hk, or you can leave a message on our Facebook page. That's Backchat on RTHK Radio 3. A couple of, just before we get back to the money, a couple of other comments. S says, I think there's a difference in restaurants opening for lunch and dinner. Dinner would encourage more group gatherings compared to lunch, which is mainly for grabbing something to eat during work break. It's still a good idea for restaurants to close for dinner while we have clusters in some areas. Also, many have been spread through restaurant group dining. Divya says, I would urge the government to discuss school closures as a pressing economic concern. First, having young children at home while parents are working from home puts immense pressure on working parents' productivity. School-aged children need a great deal of adult supervision, and Zoom classes are completely meaningless for kindergartners. Second, by keeping schools closed for so long, aren't we also sacrificing tomorrow's economic productivity? Hong Kong kids have been out of school now for 7 months. Usually teachers are concerned about the summer holiday loss that many children suffer after just a two-month break. How much ground will kids need to make up after 7 or 8 month gap? It's extraordinary that malls and restaurants are open, but libraries, schools and playgrounds are closed. That's from Divya. Thank you very much indeed for that. And S says, for your listener to put things into proper perspective, what Dr. Kwok-Kar Kee was trying to explain, this was yesterday's programme, was that those tested negative at one time might become positive later and be silent carriers and still be able to spread the virus. And therefore, unless done thoroughly and continuously, it'd be difficult to track the virus and it will not be cost effective. Jay says, this is responding, I think, to Felix Cheung, who said in the first part of the programme that people hadn't really spent their 10,000 yet. Jay says, well, your first guy out of his head. 40% of the public have probably spent their 10,000 on their food and rent. He obviously seems to think people can live on thin air. This government is hell-bent on destroying the quality of life of the poor. This government needs to concentrate on manufacturing different types of masks, clear plastic masks so you can eat underneath and drink underneath, then we get back to business as usual. We need David to head a big investigation bureau into Hong Kong white elephants and get rid of the competent idiots that are behind these money pits. Jason says, I disagree strongly with David. The ESS has been a godsend for sectors impacted by the collapse in tourism. Questions over the sector's long-term viability aside remains a huge part of Hong Kong's economy when you add in all the supporting goods and services required to support it. I work for an SME that had 50 staff at the start of the pandemic. The ESS is essentially being passed on as an unemployment benefit to all staff who would otherwise be getting nothing. without the ESS, Hong Kong would be experiencing truly terrifying levels of misery and destitution. That comes from Jason. John in Sai Kung says, dairy farm and mega chains were given about $400 million while operating and creating more profits, etc. Bizarrely, tour coach operators were paid many months ago, long before the people received their 10K. The government has wasted many millions trying to invent, stroke, create an IT hub, but now TikTok, Google and others are pulling out of Hong Kong. The government should not be giving more and more money to big business. That comes from John in Sai Kung. Dr. Ku, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Thank you very much indeed for joining us. What do you think should be the administration's priorities when it comes to spending in relation to COVID-19 in the rest of this year?
I quite like the idea of ESX, actually. I mean, even though, obviously, the intention itself is nice, but when it comes to the implementation, it's a little bit lousy. So I would say that having another stage of ESX employment support scheme could probably be a good idea. But obviously, more thoughts have to be given when it comes to the implementation detail. But actually, this is something related to the comment that you have mentioned a little bit earlier. When it comes to the comparison between the cash handout and the ESS, I mean, the rationale behind the two policies are actually quite different. When it comes to the cash handout, of course, I mean, the benefits are obvious. I mean, it helps the public, especially the poor, to relieve immediate financial pressure. But the problem is, I mean, this amount of money, say 10K, is going to run out pretty quickly. But when it comes to the ESS, I mean, this is more on the support of the firms, the support to the SME. And this is actually quite important. On one hand, SME is the backbone of the economy, of the Hong Kong economy, everyone knows that. Another one is that, I mean, when the pandemic is over, having firms, having the SME survive is actually a very, very crucial factor when we want to have a speedy economic recovery.
What is the role of the SME, you know, in our economic development, Dr. Ku? You know, as can be seen elsewhere, this pandemic has actually exposed the weaknesses in our systems.
Right.
So, you know, in our health system, in our economic system. So we see a lot of economic vulnerabilities in Hong Kong. And so we might be looking for a systemic change. For example, we don't need a lot of big offices. A lot of people can work from home, and et cetera.
It could be possible, obviously. The problem for this kind of system is that it's not going to benefit everyone in the industry or in the economy immediately. There has been a lot of investigations going on in the past several months. For example, I mean, it turns out that those people who can actually work from home are usually those having, you know, higher rank in the industry, earning more, and the lower income group are actually, I mean, do not actually have this kind of option. So, yes, I mean, on one hand, I mean, using the capacity for the citizens to work from home is crucial, but this is not going to benefit everyone. And at the same time, I mean, in the longer period of time, the government should actually consider investing more in innovation industry or education. That is actually a crucial factor.
What about at your university? You know, a lot of universities worldwide are starting online.
Actually,
learning online will be a big thing. So is that a new economic driver?
Yeah, it could be. In the past several years, actually, there are more and more discussion on this particular aspect. For example, in business education, I mean, more and more schools in the world are considering to offer some kind of online education. I mean, we can find a lot of, say, online MBA programs, for example, I mean, even before the pandemic. I would say that this is some kind of a big direction to go when it comes to online education. But at the same time, we all acknowledge that there are some kind of elements that cannot be replaced completely by an online system. So there's still, I mean, some kind of value for face-to-face education, especially when it comes to the university education.
So we don't need to demolish UST and turn it into a housing estate yet.
I don't think it's a good way to go.
Because obviously there's an option there. I mean, it's not necessarily more, doesn't add to GDP, but it might be more efficient if everybody did their degrees online and in the luxury of their own homes.
Mm-hmm. I would say that they are actually kind of a little bit different. As I've mentioned, I mean, the online education cannot really be used to 100% replace the face-to-face education, right?
I think there's got to be a step back and a review of what is our aim here with this virus, because we had through some good fortune got the local transmission rate down to zero for several weeks in a row, and everything was starting to reopen. But the government took its eye off the ball and wasn't focusing on the weaknesses and the exemptions that they'd granted in the quarantine system. And so they still had over-generous exemptions, for example, pilots who certainly need to go to and fro but don't need to go out into the community in between. They could be required to stay at home for 14 days after they've done a burst of flying and then go back into the community. We had weaknesses on the cross-border drivers. There was a cluster emerging from a food labeling warehouse, which was almost certainly brought in by a driver, and seamen and so on. You know, those things, if we want to go to zero, they have to be tightened up, and that's money well spent if we want to stay down at zero. But do we? Because, you know, other countries are moving on with their lives. The UK is still getting several hundred new cases per day diagnosed, not to mention the ones that don't go diagnosed. I think it was the last survey of antibodies showed 7% of the whole population has been infected at some point. People are starting to go on holidays again with stop and start approaches to return quarantines. But maybe the world's getting to a point where they say, look, this wasn't so bad. It can be controlled, it can't be eliminated, and what are we trying to achieve here? And let's just get the economy back up to speed, as long as the healthcare system can manage the burden of the caseload. Because, you know, you can adjust and build your healthcare system over time to adapt to that, and deal with the consequences, rather than depriving children of their school years and their futures, messing up their exam systems, and bringing the economy to a halt, restaurateurs having to close and shut down their businesses eventually, retailers deprived of tourism and so on. I mean, it's so many negative consequences. And for what real gain? How many overall lives have been spared by some of these measures? And some of them are just utterly pointless. If it's okay to sit 1.5 meters away from someone else in a restaurant with my mask off, eating at lunchtime, then why do I have to wear a mask when I'm out walking or in a country park? There's some of these measures are brought in as deflections from government failures. Rather than focus on the failure of the quarantine border control system, they introduced draconian measures requiring mask wearing outdoors, when most people, if they're in a crowded place, would wear a mask anyway. They don't need to be legislated to do that.
Fred Koo, I was just thinking about SARS, just thinking about a lot of kind of long-term of things. After SARS, the mainland, through promotion of tourism and allowing, you know, the more visitors to Hong Kong, had a big effect on the Hong Kong economy, stimulated it in many ways. Do you think, could we look forward to something like that again? Because I don't think, I can't imagine mainland tourists rushing back to Hong Kong when this is all over in quite the same way. Can you?
All right. I'm not sure. I guess, I mean, no one actually know the answer. But, well, as you have mentioned, I mean, back in 2003, when we first had, the individual business scheme, the economy was actually boosted by this kind of scheme, this kind of quote-unquote support from the mainland China government. But the problem is, as you have mentioned, I mean, the situation nowadays is kind of different, and I cannot really imagine that, I mean, we can have exactly the same kind of rebound in terms of our economic performance, I mean, right after the pandemic. On the other hand, what we can see here is that, in the early 2000s, what we can see here is that once we kind of realigned kind of quote unquote too much on the mainland, on the so-called support of the mainland China, it actually brings some other kind of problems. For example, when you look at our the data of the tourism industry in Hong Kong, I mean, after the individual visit scheme, actually, the mainland actually making up a large proportion of the tourists. So what does it actually mean to our economy? It means that our economy will be even more vulnerable to the economic fluctuation of mainland China. I mean, the same applies to our retail industry. So the questions that we are facing is, on one hand, whether this kind of a speedy recovery will be, you know, will it be feasible? That is the first question. The second question is actually whether we want it or not. I mean, do we want to go back to the same kind of situation after the current pandemic, or are we going to try to find some other ways to diversify our economy, to diversify our tourists, for example, diversify the source of the money that you are that we are earning? That is actually the second most important question.
Well, should we put another 10 or 20 billion into Ocean Park, for example, or is one theme park enough, and perhaps we just let Disneyland be that theme park? You know, then we can shut down Ocean Park and redevelop it, because right now it's just a black hole of sucking in money and staying closed. You know, but you know, if let's look forward and say everyone's got the opportunity to have a vaccine, even if there's no compulsory vaccination scheme, and let's assume that it's not totally effective, and there's still levels of virus and infections in the global community. Do we still want to keep our borders closed and manage to get down to zero and stay there and have no COVID infections? Or will we actually be saying, we can't afford to do that anymore? We've got to have international business travel, conventions, exhibitions, trade, tourism, and all of those good things, stimulating the economy, children back in school facing slight risks, but then they take risks when they cross the road. You know, should we be back to a level of risk that is more sensible after a vaccine is introduced? Because it's not a panacea. So let's say the vaccine comes and doesn't wipe out the virus, because the only virus that's ever been eliminated is smallpox. We're still trying to get rid of polio in pockets of the world. So let's assume that it's still out there, and probably in much higher numbers than polio. Are we still going to maintain this sort of lockdown, wartime mentality? Or should we just accept the situation and move on? Because I think the world has got itself into a panic situation led by politicians and the media, and there needs to be a cooling off and rethink of the whole situation.
All right, back to normality. Okay, back to short term and immediate situation. Tom on Facebook says information on how many businesses and shops have stopped paying rent would be very useful. It would appear that many may include most retail businesses, ? Now that we're in a large-scale shake-up, maybe it would also be time to revisit the idea of an estate tax in Hong Kong. In other countries, young people in their 20s start focusing on buying a home and planning for the future, almost an impossibility in Hong Kong. The hoarding of real estate and a rent-seeking economy is a classic economic problem, one which Hong Kong has done nothing to stop. Virtually every other country in the world has high taxes on real estate to keep things in check. That comes from Tom. No, you're not going to answer on that one, David Webb. Jay says, why do we keep...
Are you censoring me?
Yes. Jay says, why do we keep having news on America? We're not interested in their situation. If they don't wear masks, we want to hear about the economies of the Philippines, how they're getting on with their virus. We want to hear how Thailand is getting on with their virus. We want to hear how Indonesia is getting on with their virus and India. Backchat is becoming very America-oriented. And what about England? Let's hear lots of ideas from other countries. That is from Jay. Derek says, I don't see the difference between a restaurant being open for lunch or for dinner and the difference between a table for two and a table for four, except the restaurant being able to make a living or not. Umesh says, this is interesting, I know of many people with companies in China who have accounts offices in Hong Kong. They do not hire any employees in those offices except themselves and immediate family members, and they get those extra benefits of up to $54,000 per person. Lucky them, I guess. That's from Umesh. And Jay also says the tax office should be the bureau who knows which people need money and which people do not need money. And if you're not registered with the tax bureau, and if not, why why not, and those who are not registered with the Tax Bureau that need to claim money need to register with the Tax Bureau. That comes from Jay. Michael says, Dear Backchat, great to hear again from David Webb. Well-informed, intelligent and opinionated, so unlike many of your pundits, not just Mike Rouse. I did not realise that baby white elephants are still being planned, and now Cyberport is going to become a herd. You would have thought that Carrie would have been a safe pair of hands, but she's turned out to be just as competent as all the others. Good luck, David. That comes from Michael. And Griffin says, there's a lot of economic sense in what David Webb proposes in terms of the employment subsidy, but as usual, economists fail to take account of the human factor. Funding employers rather than providing an unemployment benefit may make more financial sense, but it also leads to a disconnect between employers and their staff. Utilising a system where bosses keep their employers keep their employees now will ultimately lead to lower unemployment in future as the boss-worker connection remains in place. That comes from Griffin. Dr. Koo, do you want to comment on that?
Well, I think it's actually quite reasonable. I mean, as I've mentioned, I mean, the idea of the employment support scheme is actually quite well. But just that when it comes to implementation, I mean, it's actually extremely difficult. And another aspect that we may actually bring in is to deal with the rental cost of the SMD. I actually quite like the idea suggested by Michael quite several months ago, saying that the government should provide tax bullets for landlords who are willing to reduce the rent of its tenant. But again, I mean, the idea or the intention seems to be good. But when it comes to implementation, it will be crucial.
Well, you know, in at business schools, Dr. Koo, I mean, there is a saying that businesses need to create shared value. You know, having a profit, of course, but to have the social value. But we don't see that really happening in Hong Kong yet. Why is that?
Well, to be honest, I mean, the idea of creating shared value, or a little bit earlier version of this, is so-called the corporate social responsibility, it doesn't really happen, say, 10 or 15 years ago. It's still part of some kind of a new idea. I would say that some major firms in Hong Kong are actually, having this kind of initiative. Like, I mean, the New World Development is kind of famous for having their CSV initiatives. But to be honest, to bring it to everyone in the economy is not going to be easy. I mean, the idea of a shareholder capitalism, saying that or suggesting that the objective of the firm is to maximize profit, it's actually quite prevailing. I mean, in the case of Hong Kong, for example. So,
of course it is. If you don't, someone else will. I mean, if you spend all your profits on helping the needy rather than paying dividends, distributing profits to your shareholders, they'll go and buy someone else's shares instead, and you'll be out of capital and out of business. So, you know, there's a role for everyone to play, and companies must comply with laws, and people must make laws that companies should obey on environment, on labour, and other things. But then companies must go out and do the best with the capital that they've been allocated. And that's why most of this, whatever you like to call it, CSR or whatever, is just greenwash. Companies pay lip service to it to make people quiet, but they carry on running their business for profit.
Okay, well, let's take a test case. For example, kindergartens. There was a survey we're discussing on the programme this morning. 40% of respondents, I think, 40% of kindergartens responded, and half of them said that they were facing closure, imminent closure, because of problems. How would you help them, or would you let them go to the wall, or what? David Webb, what would your approach be, say, for kindergartens?
Well, I'd scrap the employment support subsidy and pay the furloughed staff, because they'll obviously the teachers can't work if they're not in the kindergarten. I wouldn't support the landlords from whom they've been renting property. There's a negotiation to be had between the tenants and the landlords in any circumstance, and the government shouldn't get in the way of that. If you feel sorry for the landlords, they can still go out and sell their property. They've still got the asset, don't forget. And if they've got a mortgage against it and it's more than the value of the property now, then the bank takes the hit.
But the kindergartens that have still got to pay the rent,
As I said, they'll need to negotiate with their landlords, and the landlords will either let the space go empty or accept a lower rent. That's a commercial situation for them. But I don't feel too sorry for landlords, given that they've got the capital value of their properties, which is much greater than any year's rent. If they are suffering from cash flow, then they should sell their property.
All right. So cash for the furloughed staff. Fred Koo, how would you support, or what would you do for kindergartens? Or nothing?
Well, on one hand, I think the idea is kind of classic.
I mean, oh, and by the way, I'd reopen them, because young children are very unlikely to suffer or transmit much from the virus. They get infected, but they have little or no symptoms.
They can spread it to teachers.
Little or no symptoms. There's very little evidence of that because they don't have symptoms. They're not coughing and sneezing, right? So there's very little evidence of asymptomatic transmission as well.
Okay.
That's what the WHO says. It's not just my ignorant opinion. I've researched this, and that's their opinion. Having looked at the contact tracing that has been done all over the world now to see how people got infected, there have been very few cases of child to adult transmission.
Okay, so then you don't have to pay. Then you don't have to pay them a furlough because they're working.
There's a risk of teacher to teacher transmission, of course. That's different.
Fred Koo, what would you do for kindergartens, if anything?
Well, I'm a little bit more inclined to keep the kindergarten operating. I mean, on one hand, yes. I mean, the risk of the transmission among the children is relatively low, but when you simply let the free market to operate in this way, saying that, okay, if you suffer some kind of problem, if you cannot pay the rent, I mean, you simply shut down, go off the business. Well, this is a classical market economy, free economy. But the problem is, what is our objective here? Do we still want to keep the kindergarten operating, I mean, throughout this particular period of pandemic and actually have it running after the pandemic? If you consider the cost of shutting it down and then reopen it a while after the pandemic, I mean, this is actually costly as well. So as I mentioned earlier, I mean, keeping the business in the industry is actually very important when it comes to when you want to have a speedy recovery.
But how long would it take, and how long should we do that for? Another year?
This is a good question, right? We don't know. We don't know, to be sure. To be very honest with you guys, I mean, no one knows what is the optimal time that we should support the economy or whatsoever, even though our, you know, government officials saying that, okay, we cannot really rely endlessly on this kind of release package. Everyone knows it. I don't think this is a pure economic problem. I mean, we probably have to consult some kind of public health experts to try to estimate how long the pandemic is going to last. I mean, when will we have the vaccines, and then we will have a more accurate estimate on the risk that we are facing, and then from that we can actually try to build the plan that we have.
Okay, just some more comments, a couple of comments to finish off. TC says Sweden's policy in combating COVID is controversial in that there's been no lockdowns, no mandatory mask laws, and people still go to school, work, bars in an effort to achieve so-called herd immunity. While its death rate may be higher than its Nordic neighbours, it's much lower than the US, UK and Brazil. This brings up a good philosophical dilemma. If Sweden survived without any drastic actions that affect its economy, why do Hong Kong, or any place in the world for that matter, need to guts the economy to combat the COVID? And there's a link to a story in the New Scientist on that subject. Sam says in an email, the question that needed to be asked is whether the government has dispersed the people's money wisely. Giving 10K served no purpose. Beneficiaries were the landlords and civil servants and those earning their uninterrupted monthly salaries. Government need to think outside the box of a scheme how the money could reach the unemployed and those without an MPF scheme and needy through registration at the district offices. Protesters and pandems dominating such offices are only serving a dark hand and not the people. Pressing needs, rents and mortgages, it would have been much better. If rents and mortgages of the first time home buyers waived for 6 months instead of sweeteners, it's now coming to the third month and ESS has not reached certain employees as yet. That is from Sam. And one more comment on Facebook. This is from Ravi, who says, good to hear David again. Keep well. We echo that. Thank you very much indeed for those comments. Thank you to David Webb, chief editor of website.com, and to Dr. Fred Koo, assistant dean for undergraduate studies, director of the integrated BBA program at the Chinese University, and Felix Chung also joining us in the first part of the program this morning. That's it from us. Ada, many thanks to you, and thanks to producers Raphael and Michelle, back at 8:30 tomorrow. The weather, mainly cloudy with a few showers. Temperatures up to about 31 degrees. Squally thunderstorms and more showers later. And the wind strengthening gradually. Seas rough with swells. Windy with heavy squally showers and thunderstorms. Tomorrow, still showery on Thursday. 29 degrees now with the standby signal number one. The relative humidity is at 78%.